Dr. Jones thought, even if he'd left service in P-3s because of chronic air sickness. All these guys are using prairie masker systems when they snort. It sounds like rain on the surface, remember? Rain on the surface is on the 1,000 hertz line, so we look for rain. Jones slid a weather photo on the table, where there ain't no rain. Then we look for 60 hertz hits, little ones, short ones, brief ones, things you might otherwise ignore that happen to be where the rain is. They use 60 hertz generators and motors, right? Then we look for transients, just little dots that look like background noise that are also where the rain is. Like this. He marked the sheet with a red pen, then looked to the station's command master chief, who was leaning over the other side of the table like a curious god. I heard stories about you when I was working the ref tray at Dam Neck. I thought they were sea stories. Got a smoke? The only civilian in the room asked. The master chief handed one over. The anti-smoking signs were gone, and the ashtrays were out. Sosus was at war, and perhaps the rest of Pack Fleet would soon catch up. Jesus, I'm home, Jones told himself. Well, you know the difference between a sea story and a fairy tale. What's that, sir? Boomer asked. A fairy tale starts once upon a time, Jones said with a smile, marking another 60 hertz hit on the sheet. And a sea story starts, no shit, the Master Chief concluded the joke. Except this little fucker really was that good. I think you have enough to run a plot, Dr. Jones. I think we have a track on an SSK, Master Chief. Shame we can't prosecute. Ron nodded slowly. Yeah, me too, but now we know we can get hits on the guys. It's still going to be a mother for P-3s to localize them. They're good boats, and that's a fact. They couldn't get too carried away. All Sosus did was to generate lines of bearing. If more than one hydrophone set got a hit on the same sound source, you could rapidly triangulate bearings into locations. But those locations were circles, not points, and the circles were as much as 20 miles across. It was just physics, neither friend nor enemy. The sounds that most easily traveled long distances were of the lower frequencies, and for any sort of wave, only the higher frequencies gave the best resolution. We know where to look the next time he snorts, too. Anyway, you can call fleet operations and tell them there's nobody close to the carriers. Here, 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 surface groups. He made marks on the paper. Also, heading west at good speed and not being real covert about it. All target track bearings are opening. It's a complete disengagement. They're not looking for any more trouble. Maybe that's good. Jones crushed out the cigarette. Yeah, Master Chief, maybe it is if the flags get their shit together. The funny part was that things had actually calmed down. Morning TV coverage of the Wall Street crash was clinically precise and the analysis exquisite, probably better than Americans were getting at home, Clark thought, what with all the economics professors doing the play-by-play, along with a senior banker for color commentary. Perhaps, a newspaper editorialized, America will rethink her stance vis-a-vis Japan. Was it not clear that the two countries genuinely needed each other, especially now, and that a strong Japan served American interests as well as local ones? Prime Minister Goto was quoted in a conciliatory way, though not in front of a camera, in language that was for him decidedly unusual and widely covered for that reason. Fucking Twilight Zone, Chavez observed in a quiet moment, breaking language cover because he just had to. What the hell, he thought. They were under Russian operational control now. What rules did matter now? Ruski, his senior replied tolerantly. Da, Tavarish, was the grumbled reply. Do you have any idea what's going on? Is it a war or not? The rules sure are funny, Clark said. In English, he realized. It's getting to me, too. There were other gaijin back on the street, most of them apparently Americans, and the looks they were getting were back to the ordinary suspicion and curiosity, the current hostility level down somewhat from the previous week. So, what do we do? We try the Interfax number our friend gave us. Clark had his report all typed up. It was the only thing he knew to do, except for keeping his contacts active and fishing for information. Surely Washington knew what he had to tell them, he thought, going back into the hotel. The clerk smiled and bowed, a little more politely this time as they headed to the elevator. 2 minutes later they were in the room. Clark took the laptop from its carry case, inserted the phone plug in the back, and switched it on. Another minute, and the internal modem dialed the number he'd gotten over breakfast, linking to a line across the Sea of Japan to the Siberian mainland, thence to Moscow, he supposed. He heard the electronic trilling of a ringing phone and waited for link-up. The station chief had gotten over the cringing associated with having a Russian intelligence officer in the embassy communications room, but he hadn't quite gotten to the whimsy stage yet. The noise from the computer startled him.
"Very clever technique," the visitor said.
"We try." Anyone who had ever used a modem would recognize the sound, the rasp of running water, or perhaps a floor-polishing brush. Just a digital hiss, really, of two electronic units attempting to synchronize themselves so that data could be exchanged. Sometimes it took but a few seconds, sometimes as many as 5 or even 10. In fact, it only took 1 second or so with these units, and the remaining hiss was actually the random-appearing digital code of 19,200 characters of information crossing the fiber-optic line per second, first in one direction, then the other. When the real transmission was concluded, formal lockup was achieved, and the guy at the other end sent his 20 column inches for the day. Just to be on the safe side, the Russians would make sure that the report would be carried in 2 newspapers the next day, on page 3 in both cases. No sense in being too obvious. Then came the hard part for the CIA station chief. On command, he printed 2 copies of the same report, one of which went to the RVS officer. Was Mary Pat going through change of life or something?
His Russian is very literary, even classical. Who taught him my language?
I honestly don't know, the station chief lied. Successfully, as it turned out. The hell of it was, the Russian was right. That occasioned a frown.
Want me to help with the translation?
Shit, he smiled.
Sure. Why not?
Ryan. A whole 5 hours of sleep, Jack grumped, lifting the secure car phone. Well, at least he wasn't doing the driving.
Mary Pat here. We have something. It'll be on your desk when you get there.
How good?
It's a start, the DDO said. She was very economical in her use of words. Nobody really trusted radio phones, secure or not.
Hello, Dr. Ryan. I'm Andrea Price.
The agent was already dressed in a lab coat, complete with picture pass, clipped to the lapel, which she held up.
My uncle's a doctor, GP in Wisconsin. I think he'd like this, she smiled.
Do I have anything to worry about?
I really don't think so, Agent Price said, still smiling.
Protectees didn't like to see worried security personnel, she knew.
What about my children? There are 2 agents outside their school, and 1 more is in the house across from the daycare center for your little one, the agent explained. Please, don't worry. They pay us to be paranoid, and we're almost always wrong. But it's like in your business. You always want to be wrong on the safe side, right?
And my visitors? Kathy asked.
Can I make a suggestion?
Yes.
Get them all Hopkins lab coats, souvenirs-like. I'll eyeball them all when they change.
That was pretty clever, Kathy Ryan thought.
You're carrying a gun?
Always,
Andrea Price confirmed.
But I've never had to use it. Never even took it out for an arrest.
Just think of me as a fly on the wall, she said.
More like a falcon, Professor Ryan thought, but at least a tame one.
How are we supposed to do that, John? Chavez asked in English.
The shower was running. Ding was sitting on the floor and John on the toilet. Well, we've seen him already, haven't we? The senior officer pointed out.
Yeah, in the fucking factory.
Well, we just have to find out where they went. On the face of it, the statement was reasonable enough. They just had to determine how many and where, and, oh, by the way, whether or not there were really nukes riding on the nose, no big deal. All they knew was that they were SS-19-type launchers, the new improved version thereof, and that they'd left the factory by rail. Of course, the country had over 28,000 kilometers of rail lines. It would have to wait.
Intelligence officers often worked bankers' hours, and this was one of those cases. Clark decided to get into the shower to clean off before heading for bed. He didn't know what to do yet, or how to go about it. But worrying himself to death would not improve his chances, and he'd long since learned that he worked better with a full 8 hours under his belt, and occasionally had a creative thought while showering. Sooner or later, Ding might learn those tricks as well, he thought, seeing the expression on the kid's face. "Hi, Betsy," Jack said to the lady waiting in his office's anteroom. "You're up early. And who are you?" "Chris Scott. Betsy and I work together." Jack waved them into his office, first checking his fax machine to see if Mary Pat had transmitted the information from Clark and Chavez, and seeing it there, decided it could wait. He knew Betsy Fleming from his CIA days as a self-taught expert on strategic weapons. He supposed Chris Scott was one of the kids recruited from some university with a degree in what Betsy had learned the hard way. At least the younger one was polite about it, saying that he worked with Betsy. So had Ryan once years ago, while concerned with arms control negotiations. "Okay, what do we have?" "Here's what they call the H-11 space booster." Scott opened his case and pulled out some photos, good ones, Ryan saw at once, made with real film at close range, not the electronic sort, shot through a hole in someone's pocket. It wasn't hard to tell the difference, and Ryan immediately recognized an old friend he'd thought dead and decently buried less than a week before. "Sure as hell, the SS-19. A lot prettier this way, too." Another photo showed a string of them on the assembly building's floor. Jack counted them and grimaced. "What else do I need to know?" "Here," Betsy said. "Check out the business end."
"Looks normal," Ryan observed.
"That's the point. The nose assembly is normal," Scott pointed out. "Normal for supporting a warhead bus, not for a Commosat payload. We wrote that up a while back, but nobody paid any attention to it," the technical analyst added. "The rest of the bird's been fully re-engineered. We have estimates for the performance enhancements."
"Short version."
6 or 7 MIRVs each and a range of just over 10,000 kilometers," Mrs. Fleming replied. "Worst case, but realistic."
"That's a lot.
Has the missile been certified, tested? Have they tested a bus that we know of?" the National Security Advisor asked. "No data. We have partial stuff on flight tests of the launcher from surveillance in the Pacific, stuff Amber Ball caught, but it's equivocal on several issues," Scott told him.
"Total birds turned out?"
25 we know about. Of those, 3 have been used up in flight tests, and 2 are at their launch facilities being mated up with orbital payloads. That leaves 20.
"What payloads?" Ryan asked, almost on a whim.
"The NASA guys think they're survey satellites, real-time capable photosats. So probably they are," Betsy said darkly.
"And so probably they've decided to enter the overhead intelligence business. Well, that makes sense, doesn't it?" Ryan made a couple of notes.
"Okay, the downside worst-case threat is 20 launchers with 7 MIRVs each for a total of 140? "Correct, Dr. Ryan." Both were professional enough that they didn't editorialize on how bad that threat was. Japan had the theoretical capacity to cut the hearts out of 140 American cities. America could quickly reconstitute the ability to turn their home islands into smoke and fire as well, but that wasn't a hell of a lot of consolation, was it? 40-plus years of mad, thought to be ended less than 7 days before, and now it was back again, Ryan thought. Wasn't that just wonderful? "Do you know anything about the assets that produced these photos?"
"Jack," Betsy said in her normal June Cleaver voice, "you know I never ask. But whoever it was overt, you can tell from the photos. These weren't done with a Minox. Somebody covered as a reporter, I bet."
"Don't worry, I won't tell," her usual impish smile. She had been around long enough that she knew all the tricks.
"They're obviously high-quality photos," Chris Scott went on, wondering how the hell Betsy had the clout to call this man by his first name.
"Slow, small-grain film, like what a reporter uses. They let NASA guys into the factory, too. They wanted us to know."
"Sure as hell," Mrs. Fleming nodded agreement. And the Russians, Ryan reminded himself. Why them?
Anything else?
Yeah, this. Scott handed over two more photos. It showed a pair of modified railroad flat cars. One had a crane on it. The other showed the hard points for installing another. They evidently transport by rail instead of truck. I had a guy look at the rail car. It's apparently standard gauge.
What do you mean? Ryan asked.
The width between the rails. Standard gauge is what we use in most of the rest of the world. Most of the railways in Japan are narrow gauge. Funny, they didn't copy the road transporters the Russians made for the beast, Scott said. Maybe their roads are too narrow, or maybe they just prefer to do it this way. There's a standard gauge line from here to Yoshinobu. I was a little surprised by the rigging gear. The cradles in the rail car seemed to roughly match the dimensions of the transport cocoon that the Russians designed for the beast, so they copied everything but the transporter. That's all we have, sir.
Where are you off to next?
We're huddling across the river with the guys at NRO, Chris Scott answered.
Good, Ryan said.
He pointed at both of them. You tell them, this one's hotter in hell. I want these things found and found yesterday. You know they'll try, Jack. And they may have done us a favor by rolling these things out on rails, Betsy Fleming said as she stood. Jack organized the photos and asked for another complete set before he dismissed his visitors. Then he checked his watch and called Moscow. Ryan supposed that Sergei was working long hours, too. Why the hell, he began, did you sell them the SS-19 design? The reply was harsh. Perhaps Golovko was sleep-deprived as well. For money, of course, the same reason you sold them Aegis, the F-15, and all... Ryan grimaced, mainly at the justice in the retort. Thanks, pal, I guess I deserved that. We estimate they have 20 available. That would be about right, but we haven't had people visit their factory yet.
We have, Ryan told him. Want some pictures?
Of course, Ivan Demetrovich.
They'll be on your desk tomorrow, Jack promised. I have our estimate. I'd like to hear what your people think.
He paused and then went on. We are worst casing at 7 RVs per missile for a total of 140.
Enough for both of us, Golovko observed.
Remember when we first met, negotiating to remove those fucking things?
He heard Ryan's snort over the phone. He didn't hear what his colleague was thinking. The first time I was close to those things aboard your missile submarine, Red October. Yeah, I remember that. I remember feeling my skin crawl like I was in the presence of Lucifer himself. He'd never had the least bit of affection for ballistic weapons. Oh, sure, maybe they'd kept the peace for 40 years. Maybe the thought of them had deterred their owners from the intemperate thoughts that had plagued chiefs of state for all of human history. Or just as likely mankind had just been lucky for once.
Jack, this is getting rather serious, Golovko said.
By the way, our officer met with your officers. He reports favorably on them, and thank you, by the way, for the copy of their report. It included data we did not have. Not vitally important, but interesting even so.
So tell me, do they know to seek out these rockets?
The order went out, Ryan assured him.
To my people as well, Ivan Emitovich. We will find them, never fear,
Golovko felt the need to add. He had to be thinking the same thing. The only reason the missiles had not been used was that both sides had possessed them, because it was like threatening a mirror. That was no longer true, was it? And so came Ryan's question.
And then what? He said darkly.
What do we do then?
Do you not say in your language one thing at a time?
Isn't this just great? Now I have a friggin' Russian trying to cheer me up.
Thank you, Sergei Nikolaevich. Perhaps I deserve that as well.
So, why did we sell Citibank? George Winston asked.
Well, he said to look out for banks that were vulnerable to currency fluctuations, Gant replied.
He was right. We got out just in time. Look, see for yourself. The trader typed another instruction into his terminal and was rewarded with a graphic depiction of what First National Citibank stock had done on Friday.
And sure enough, it had dropped off the table in one big hurry, largely because Columbus, which had purchased the issue in large quantities over the preceding 5 weeks, had held quite a bit, and in selling it had shaken faith in the stock badly. Anyway, that set off an alarm in our program.
Mark, Citibank is one of the benchmark stocks in the model, isn't it? Winston asked calmly. There was nothing to be gained by leaning on Mark too hard.
Oh, his eyes opened a little wider.
Well, yes, it is, isn't it?
That was when a very bright light blinked on in Winston's mind. It was not widely known how the expert systems kept track of the market. They worked in several interactive ways, monitoring both the market as a whole and also modeling benchmark stocks more closely as general indicators of developing market trends. Those were stocks which over time had tracked closely with what everything else was doing, with a bias toward general stability, those that both dropped and rose more slowly than the more speculative issues, steady performers. There were two reasons for it, and one glaring mistake. The reasons were that while the market fluctuated every day, even in the most favorable of circumstances, the idea was to not only bag an occasional killing on a high flyer, but also to hedge your money on safe stocks. Not that any stock was truly safe, as Friday had proven, when everything else became unsettled. For those reasons, the benchmark stocks were those that over time had provided safe havens. The mistake was a common one. Dice have no memory. Those benchmark stocks were such because the companies they represented had historically good management. Management could change over time. So it was not the stocks that were stable, it was the management, and that was only something from the past whose currency had to be examined periodically, despite which those stocks were used to grade trends. And a trend was a trend only because people thought it was, and in thinking so, they made it so. Winston had regarded benchmark stocks only as predictors of what the people in the market would do, and for him, trends were always psychological, predictors of how people would follow an artificial model, not the performance of the model itself. Gant, he realized, didn't quite see it that way, like so many of the technical traders. And in selling off, Citibank Columbus had activated a little alarm in its own computer trading system. And even someone as bright as Mark had forgotten that Citibank was part of the goddamned model.
"Show me other bank stocks," Winston ordered.
"Well, chemical went next," Gant told him, pulling up that track as well.
"Then Manny Hanny, and then others, too. Anyway, we saw it coming, and we jumped into metals and gold stocks.
You know, when the dust settles, it's going to turn out that we did okay. Not great, but pretty okay," Gant said, calling up his executive program for overall transactions, wanting to show something he'd done right. "I took the money from a quick flip on Silicon Alchemy and laid this put on GM," and Winston patted him on the shoulder.
"Save that for later, Mark. I can see it was a good play."
"Anyway, we were ahead of the trends all the way. Yeah, we got a little hurt when the calls came in and we had to dump a lot of solid things. But that happened to everybody."
"You don't see it, do you?"
"See what, George?"
"We were the trend."
Mark Gant blinked his eyes and Winston could tell.
He didn't see it.
Chapter 29 Written Records. The presentation went very well, and at the end of it, Kathy Ryan was handed an exquisitely wrapped box by the professor of ophthalmic surgery from Chiba University, who led the Japanese delegation. Unwrapping it, she found a scarf of watered blue silk embroidered with gold thread. It looked to be more than 100 years old.
"The blue goes so well with your eyes, Professor Ryan," her colleague said, with a smile of genuine admiration. "I fear it is not a sufficiently valuable gift for what I have learned from you today. I have hundreds of diabetic patients at my hospital. With this technique, we can hope to restore sight for most of them. A magnificent breakthrough, Professor."
He bowed formally and with clear respect.
"Well, the lasers come from your country," Kathy replied. She wasn't sure what emotion she was supposed to have. The gift was stunning. the man was as sincere as he could be, and his country might be at war with hers. But why wasn't it on the news? If there were a war, why was this foreigner not under arrest? Was she supposed to be gracious to him as a learned colleague or hostile to him as an enemy? What the hell was going on? She looked over at Andrea Price, who just leaned against the back wall and smiled, her arms crossed across her chest. "And you have taught us how to use them more efficiently. A stunning piece of applied research." The Japanese professor turned to the others and raised his hands. The assembled multitude applauded, and a blushing Carolyn Ryan started thinking that she just might get the Lasker's statuette for her mantelpiece after all. Everyone shook her hand before leaving for the bus that waited to take them back to the Stouffer's on Pratt Street. "Can I see it?" Special Agent Price asked after all were gone and the door safely closed. Kathy handed the scarf over. "Lovely. You'll have to buy a new dress to go with it." "So there never was anything to worry about," Dr. Ryan observed. Interestingly, once she'd gotten 15 seconds into her lecture, she'd forgotten about it anyway. Wasn't that interesting? "No, like I told you, I didn't expect anything." Price handed the scarf back, not without some reluctance. The little professor was right, she thought. It did go nicely with her eyes. "Jack Ryan's wife," was all she'd heard, and then some. "How long have you been doing this?" "Retinal surgery?" Kathy closed her notebook. "I started off working the front end of the eye, right up to the time little Jack was born. Then I had an idea about how the retina is attached naturally, and how we might reattach bad ones. Then we started looking at how to fix blood vessels. Bernie let me run with it, and I got a research grant from NIH to play with, and one thing led to another. And now you're the best in the world at this," Price concluded the story. "Until somebody with better hands comes along and learns how to do it, yes," Kathy smiled. "I suppose I am, for a few more months anyway." "So, how's the champ?" Bernie Katz asked, entering the room and seeing Price for the first time. The pass on her coat puzzled him. "Do I know you?" "Andrea Price." The agent gave Katz a quick and thorough visual check before shaking hands. He actually found it flattering until she added, "Secret Service." "Where were the cops like you when I was a kid?" the surgeon asked gallantly. "Bernie was one of my first mentors here. He's department chairman now," Kathy explained. "About to be overtaken in prestige by my colleague. I come bearing good news. I have a spy on the Lasker committee. You're in the finals, Kathy."
"What's a Lasker?" Price asked.
"There's one step up from a Lasker prize," Bernie told her. "You have to go to Stockholm to collect it."
"Bernie, I'll never have one of those. Alaska is hard enough."
"So keep researching, girl." Katz hugged her and left.
"I want it, I want it, I want it," Kathy told herself silently. She didn't have to give voice to the words. It was plain for Special Agent Price to see. Damn, didn't this beat guarding politicians?
"Can I watch one of your procedures?"
"If you want.
Anyway, come on." Kathy led her back to her office, not minding her at all now. On the way, they walked through the clinic, then one of the labs. In the middle of a corridor, Dr. Ryan stopped dead in her tracks, reached into her pocket, and pulled out a small notebook.
"Did I miss something?" Price asked.
She knew she was talking too much, but it took time to learn the habits of your protectees. She also read Kathy Ryan as the type who didn't like being protected and so needed to be made comfortable about it.
"You'll have to get used to me," Professor Ryan said, smiling as she scribbled a few notes. "Whenever I have an idea, I write it down right away."
"Don't you trust your memory?"
"Never."
"You can't trust your memory with things that affect live patients. One of the first things they teach you in medical school."
Kathy shook her head as she finished up.
"Not in this business. Too many opportunities to screw up. If you don't write it down, then it never happened."
That sounded like a good lesson to remember, Andrea Price told herself, following her principal down the corridor. The code name Surgeon was perfect for her. Precise, smart, thorough. She might even have made a good agent, except for her evident discomfort around guns. It was already a regular routine, and in many ways that was not new.
For a generation, the Japanese Air Self-Defense Force had responded to Russian fighter activity out of the forward base at Dolin Sokol, at first in cooperation with the USAF, and one of the regular tracks taken by the Soviet Air Force had earned the name Tokyo Express, probably an unknowing reference to a term invented in 1942 by the United States Marines on Guadalcanal. For security reasons, the E-767s were based with the 6th Air Wing at Komatsu near Tokyo, but the two F-15Js that operated under the control of the E-767 now aloft over the town of Nemuro at the northeast tip of the island of Hokkaido were actually based on the home island at Chitose. These were 100 miles offshore and each carried 8 missiles, 4 each of heat seekers and radar homers. All were warshots now, requiring only a target. It was after midnight local time. The pilots were well-rested and alert, comfortably strapped into their ejection seats. Their sharp eyes scanning the darkness while fingers made delicate course corrections on the sticks. Their own targeting radars were switched off, and though their aircraft still flashed with anti-collision strobe lights, those were easily switched off should the necessity arise, making them visually non-existent. Eagle 1-5, the digital radio, told the element leader, check out commercial traffic 50 kilometers, 035 your position, course 215, Angels 36. Roger, Kami, the pilot replied on keying his radio. Kami, the call sign for the orbiting surveillance aircraft, was a word with many meanings, most of them supernatural, like soul or spirit. And so they had rapidly become the modern manifestation of the spirits guarding their country, with the F-15Js as the strong arms that gave power to the will of those spirits. On command, the two fighters came right, climbing on a shallow, fuel-efficient slope for 5 minutes, until they were at 37,000 feet, cruising outbound from their country at 500 knots, their radars still off, but now they received a digital feed from the Kami that appeared on their own sets, one more of the new innovations, and something the Americans didn't have. The element leader alternated his eyes up and down. A pity, he thought, that the hand-off display didn't integrate with his head-up display. Maybe the next modification would do that. There, he said over his low-power radio. I have it, his wingman acknowledged. Both fighters turned to the left now, descending slowly behind what appeared to be an Air Canada 767ER. Yes, the floodlit tail showed the maple leaf logo of that airline, probably the regular transpolar flight out of Toronto International into Narita. The timing was about right. They approached from almost directly astern, not quite exactly, lest an overly quick overtake result in a ramming, and the buffet told them that they were in the wake turbulence of a heavy, a wide-bodied commercial transport. The flight leader closed until he could see the line of cabin lights and the huge engine under each wing and the stubby nose of the Boeing product. He keyed his radio again. Kami, Eagle 1-5. Eagle. Positive identification, Air Canada 767 Echo Romeo, inbound at indicated course and speed. Interestingly, the drill for the BARCAP, Barrier Combat Air Patrol, was to use English. That was the international language of aviation. All their pilots spoke it, and it worked better for important communications. Roger. And on further command, the fighters broke off to their programmed patrol area. The Canadian pilot of the airliner would never know that two armed fighters had closed to within 300 meters of his aircraft. But then he had no reason to expect that any would, because the world was at peace, at least this part of it. For their part, the fighter drivers accepted their new duties phlegmatically, along with a modification in their daily patterns of existence. For the indefinite future, no less than 2 fighters would hold this patrol station, with 2 more back at Chitose. At +5 alert, and another 4 at +30. Their wing commander was pressing for permission to increase his alert status further still, for despite what Tokyo said, their nation was at war, and that was what he told his people.
The Americans were formidable adversaries, he'd said in his first lecture to his pilots and senior ground staff. Clever ones, devious and dangerously aggressive. Worst of all, at their best, they were utterly unpredictable, the reverse of the Japanese, who, he'd gone on, tended to be highly predictable. Perhaps that was why he'd been posted to this command, the pilots thought. If things went further, the first contact with hostile American forces would be here. He wanted to be ready for it, despite the huge price of money, fuel, and fatigue that attended it. The pilots thoroughly approved. War was a serious business, and though new to it, they didn't shrink from its responsibilities. The time factor would soon become his greatest frustration, Ryan thought. Tokyo was 14 hours ahead of Washington. It was dark there now, and the next day, and whatever clever idea he might come up with would have to wait hours until implementation. The same was true in the I.O., but at least he had direct comms to Admiral Dubrow's battle force. Getting word to Clark and Chavez meant going via Moscow and then farther, either by contact via RVS officer in Tokyo, not something to be done too frequently, or by reverse modem message whenever Clark lit up his computer for a dispatch to the Interfax news agency. That would necessarily be a lag time in anything he did, and that could get people killed. It was about information. It always was, always would be. The real trick was in finding out what was going on, what was the other side doing, what were they thinking. What is it that they want to accomplish, he asked himself. War was always about economics, one of the few things that Marx had gotten right. It was just greed, really, as he'd told the president, an armed robbery writ large. At the nation-state level, the terms were couched in terms such as manifest destiny, or Lebensraum, or other political slogans to grab the attention and ardor of the masses, but that's what it came down to. They have it. We want it. Let's get it. And yet, the Mariana Islands weren't worth it. They were simply not worth the political or economic cost. This affair would ipso facto cost Japan her most lucrative trading partner. There could be no recovery from this, not for years. The market positions, so carefully established and exploited since the 1960s, would be obliterated by something politely termed public resentment, but far more deeply felt than that. For what possible reason could a country so married to the idea of business turn its back on practical considerations? But war is never rational, Jack. You told the president that yourself. So tell me, what the hell are they thinking? He commanded, instantly regretting the profanity. They were in a basement conference room. For the first meeting of the working group, Scott Adler was absent, off with Secretary Hansen. There were two national intelligence officers and four people from state, and they looked as puzzled and bemused as he did, Ryan thought. Wasn't that just great? For several seconds, nothing happened. Hardly unexpected, Jack thought. It was always a matter of clinical interest for him when he asked for real opinions from a group of bureaucrats. Who would say what? They're mad and they're scared. It was Chris Cook, one of the commercial guys from state. He'd done two tours at the embassy in Tokyo, spoke the language passably well, and had run point on several rounds of the trade negotiations, always taking back seat to senior men and women, but usually the guy who did the real work. That was how things were, and Jack remembered resenting that others sometimes got the credit for his ideas. He nodded at the comment, seeing that the others around the table did the same, grateful that someone else had taken the initiative. I know why they're mad. Tell me why they're scared. Well, hell, they still have the Russians close by and the Chinese, both still major powers. But we've withdrawn from the Western Pacific, right? In their mind, it leaves them high and dry, and now it looks to them like we've turned on them. That makes us potential enemies, too, doesn't it? Where does that leave them? What real friends do they have? Why take the Marianas? Jack asked, reminding himself that Japan had not been attacked by those countries in historically recent times, but had done so herself to all of them. Cook had made a perhaps unintended point. How did Japan respond to outside threats? By attacking first. It gives them defensive depth, bases outside their home islands.
Okay, that makes sense, Jack thought. Satellite photos less than an hour old hung on the wall. There were fighters now on the airstrips at Saipan and Guam, along with E-2C Hawkeye airborne early warning birds of the same type that operated off American carriers. That created a defensive barrier that extended 1,200 miles almost due south from Tokyo. It could be seen as a formidable wall against American attacks and was, in essence, a reduced version of Japanese grand strategy in the Second World War. Again, Cook had made a sound observation. "But are we really a threat to them?" he asked. "We certainly are now," Cook replied. "Because they forced us to be," one of the NIOs snarled, entering the discussion. Cook leaned across the table at him. "Why do people start wars? Because they're afraid of something. For Christ's sake, they've gone through more governments in the last 5 years than the Italians. The country is politically unstable. They have real economic problems. Until recently, their currency's been in trouble. Their stock market's gone down the tubes because of our trade legislation, and we've faced them with financial ruin. And you ask why they got a little paranoid? If something like this happened to us, what the hell would we do?" the Deputy Assistant Secretary of State demanded, rather cowing the National Intelligence Officer Ryan saw. Good, he thought. A lively discussion was usually helpful, as the hottest fire made the strongest steel. "My sympathy for the other side is mitigated by the fact that they have invaded U.S. territory and violated the human rights of American citizens." The reply to Cook's tirade struck Ryan as somewhat arch. The response was that of a lead hound on the scent of a crippled fox able to play with the quarry instead of the other way around for a change. Always a good feeling. "And we've already put a couple thousand of their citizens out of work. What about their rights?" "Fuck their rights. Whose side are you on, Cook?" The Das just leaned back into his chair and smiled as he slid the knife in. "I thought I was supposed to tell everyone what they're thinking. Isn't that what we're here for? What they're thinking is that we've jerked them around, bashed them, belittled them, and generally let them know that we tolerate them through sufferance and not respect since before I was born. We've never dealt with them as equals, and they think that they deserve better from us, and they don't like it. And you know," Cook went on, "I don't blame them for feeling that way. Okay, so now they've lashed out. That's wrong, and I deplore it. But we need to recognize that they tried to do it in as non-lethal a way as possible, consistent with their strategic goals. That's something we need to consider here, isn't it?" "The ambassador says his country is willing to let it stop here," Ryan told them, noting the look in Cook's eyes. Clearly he'd been thinking about the situation, and that was good. "Are they serious?" He'd asked another tough question again, something that the people around the table didn't much like. Tough questions require definitive answers, and such answers could often be wrong. It was toughest for the NIOs. The National Intelligence Officers were senior people from CIA, DIA, or NSA, usually. One of them was always with the president to give him an opinion in the event of a rapidly evolving crisis. They were supposed to be experts in their fields, and they were, as for that matter was Ryan, who'd been an NIO himself. But there was a problem with such people. An NIO was generally a serious, tough-minded man or woman. They didn't fear death, but they did fear being wrong on a hard call. For that reason, even putting a gun to one's head didn't guarantee an unequivocal answer to a tough question. He looked from face to face, seeing that Cook did the same with contempt on his face. "Yes, sir. I think it's likely that they are. It's also likely that they will offer us something back. They know that they have to let us save face here, too. We can count on it, and that will work in our favor if we choose to negotiate with them."
"Would you recommend that?"
A smile and a nod. "It never hurts you to talk with somebody, no matter what the situation is, does it? I'm a State Department puke, remember? I have to recommend that. I don't know the military side. I don't know if we can contest this thing or not. I presume we can, and that they know we can, and that they know they're gambling, and that they're even more scared than we are. We can use that in our favor."
"What can we press for?" Ryan asked, chewing on his pen.
"Status quo ante," Cook replied at once. "Complete withdrawal from the Marianas, restoration of the islands and their citizens to U.S. rule, reparations to the families of the people killed, punishment of those responsible for their deaths." Even the NIOs nodded at that, Ryan saw. He was already starting to like Cook. He spoke his mind, and what he said had a logic to it. "What will we get?" Again the answer was plain and simple. "Less." Where the hell has Scott Adler been hiding this guy, Ryan thought. He speaks my language. "They have to give us something, but they won't give it all back." "And if we press?" the National Security Advisor asked. "If we want it all back, then we may have to fight for it," Cook said. "If you want my opinion, that's dangerous." Ryan excused the facile conclusion. He was, after all, a State Department puke and part of that culture. "Will the ambassador have the clout to negotiate?" "I think so, yes," Cook said after a moment. "He has a good staff. He's a very senior professional diplomat. He knows Washington, and he knows how to play in the bigs. That's why they sent him here." "Jaw, jaw is better than war, war," Jack remembered the words of Winston Churchill, and that was true, especially if the former did not entirely preclude the threat of the latter. "Okay," Ryan said. "I have some other things that need doing. You guys stay here. I want a position paper. I want options. I want multiple opening positions for both sides. I want endgame scenarios. I want likely responses on their part to theoretical military moves on our part. Most of all," he said directly to the NIOs, "I want a feel for their nuclear capacity and the conditions under which they might feel the need to make use of it." "What warning will we have?" The question surprisingly came from Cook. The answer surprisingly came from the other NIO, who felt the need now to show something of what he knew. "The Cobra Dane radar on Shemya still works. So do the DSPS satellites. We'll get launch warning and impact prediction if it comes to that. Dr. Ryan, have we done anything?" "The Air Force has air-launched cruise missiles in the stockpile. They would be carried in by B-1 bombers. We also have the option of rearming Tomahawk cruise missiles with W-80 warheads as well for launch by submarines or surface ships. The Russians know that we may exercise that option, and they will not object so long as we keep it quiet." "That's an escalation," Cook warned. "We want to be careful about that."
"What about their SS-19s?" the second NIO inquired delicately.
"They think they need them. It will not be easy to talk them out of them." Cook looked around the table. "We have nuked their country, remember. It's a very sensitive subject, and we're dealing with people motivated by paranoia. I recommend caution on that issue."
"Noted," Ryan said as he stood. "You know what I want, people. Get to work." It felt a little good to be able to give an order like that, but less so to have to do it, and less still in anticipation of the answers he would receive for his questions. But you had to start somewhere.
"Another hard day?" Nomuri asked. "I thought with your mother gone it would get easier," Kazuo said.
He shook his head, leaning back against the fine wood rim of the tub.
"I was wrong."
The others nodded curt agreement at their friend's observation, and they all missed Taoka's sexual stories now. They needed the distraction, but only Nomuri knew why they had ended.
"So, what is going on? Now, Goto says that we need America. Last week they were our enemies, and now we are friendly again." "This is very confusing for a simple person like me," Chet said, rubbing his closed eyes and wondering what the bait would draw.
Developing his rapport with these men had not been easy because they and he were so different, and it was to be expected that he would envy them and they him. He was an entrepreneur, they thought, who ran his own business, and they the senior salarymen of major corporations. They had security, he had independence. They were expected to be overworked. He marched to his own drum. They had more money, he had less stress, and now they had knowledge, and he did not.
"We have confronted America," one of their number said. "So I gather. Isn't that highly dangerous?"
In the short term, yes, Taoka said, letting the blisteringly hot water soothe his stress-knotted muscles. Though I think we have already won.
But won what, my friend?
I feel I have started watching a mystery in the middle of the show, and all I know is that there's a pretty, mysterious girl on the train to Osaka. He referred to a dramatic convention in Japan, mysteries based on how efficiently the nation's trains ran.
Well, as my boss tells it, another senior aide decided to explain, it means true independence for our country.
Aren't we independent already? Nomori asked in open puzzlement. There are hardly any American soldiers here to annoy us anymore.
And those under guard now, Taoka observed.
You don't understand. Independence means more than politics. It means economic independence, too. It means not going to others for what we need to survive.
It means the Northern Resource Area, Kazuo, another of their number said, going too far and knowing it from the way two pairs of eyes opened in warning.
I wish it would mean shorter days and getting home on time for a change instead of sleeping in a damned coffin tube two or three nights a week, one of the more alert ones said to alter the course of the conversation.
Taoka grunted.
Yes, how can one get a girl in there?
The guffaws that followed that one were forced, Nomori thought.
You salarymen and your secrets. Ha! The CIA officer snapped. I hope you do better with your women.
He paused.
Will all this affect my business?
A good idea, he thought, to ask a question like that.
For the better, I should think, Kazuo said. There was general agreement on that point. We must all be patient. There will be hard times before the good ones truly come.
But they will come, another suggested confidently. The really hard part is behind us.
Not if I can help it, Nomori didn't tell them.
But what the hell did Northern Resource Area mean? It was so like the intelligence business that he knew he'd heard something important quite without knowing what the hell it was all about. Then he had to cover himself with a lengthy discourse on his new relationship with the hostess, to be sure again that they would remember this and not his questions. It was a shame to have to arrive in the darkness, but that was mere fortune. Half of the fleet had diverted for Guam, which had a far better natural harbor because all the people in these islands had to see the Japanese Navy. Admiral Sato was weary of the Self-Defense Force title. His was a navy now, composed of fighting ships and fighting men that had tasted battle, after a fashion. And if historians would later comment that their battle had not been a real one or a fair one, well, what military textbook did not cite the value of surprise and offensive operations? None that he knew of, the admiral told himself, seeing the loom of Mount Tokpochao through his binoculars. There was already a powerful radar there up and operating, his electronics technicians had told him an hour earlier, yet another important factor in defending what was again his country's native soil. He was alone on the starboard bridge wing in the pre-dawn gloom. Such an odd term, he thought. Gloom? Not at all. There was a wonderful peace to this, especially when you were alone to keep it to yourself and your mind started editing the distractions out. Above his head was the faint buzz of electronic gear like a hive of slumbering bees, and that noise was soon blanked out. There was also the distant hum of the ship's systems, mostly the engines and air conditioning blowers, he knew, shrugging it off. There were no human noises to trouble him. The captain of Mutsu enforced good bridge discipline. The sailors didn't speak unless they had reason to, concentrating on their duties as they were supposed to do. One by one, Admiral Sato eliminated the extraneous noises. That left only the sound of the sea, the wonderful swish of steel hull parting the waves. He looked down to see it, the fan-shaped foam whose white was both brilliant and faint at the same time, and aft the wide swath was a pleasant fluorescent green from the disturbance of phytoplankton, tiny creatures that came to the surface at night for reasons Sato had never troubled himself to understand. Perhaps to enjoy the moon and stars, he told himself with a smile in the darkness. Ahead was the island of Saipan, just a space on the horizon blacker than the darkness itself. It seemed so because it occulted the stars on the western horizon, and a seaman's mind knew that where there were no stars on a clear night, then there had to be land. The lookouts at their stations atop the forward superstructure had seen it long before him, but that didn't lessen the pleasure of his own discovery, and as with sailors of every generation, there was something special to a landfall, because every voyage ended with discovery of some sort, and so had this one. More sounds. First, the jerky whirs of electrical motors turning radar systems. Then something else. He knew he was late noticing it off to starboard, a deep rumble like something tearing, growing rapidly in intensity until he knew it could only be the roar of an approaching aircraft. He lowered his binoculars and looked off to the right, seeing nothing, until his eyes caught movement close aboard and two dart shapes streaked overhead. Mutsu trembled in their wake, giving Admiral Sato a chill followed by a flush of anger. He pulled open the door to the wheelhouse.
"What the hell was that?"
"Two F-3s conducting an attack drill," the officer of the deck replied. "They've been tracking them in CIC for several minutes. We had them illuminated with our missile trackers."
"Will someone tell those wild eagles that flying directly over a ship in the dark risks damage to us and foolish death to them?"
"But, Admiral," the OOD tried to say,
"but we are a valuable fleet unit, and I do not wish one of my ships to have to spend a month in the yard having our mast replaced, because some damn fool of an aviator couldn't see us in the dark."
"Hi, I will make the call at once."
"Spoiling my morning that way," Sato fumed, going back out to sit in the leather chair and doze off.
Was he the first guy to figure it out, Winston asked himself. Then he asked himself why he should find that surprising. The FBI and the rest were evidently trying to put things back together, and their main effort was probably to defend against fraud. Worse, they were also going over all the records, not just those of the Columbus Group. It had to be a virtual ocean of data, and they would have been unfamiliar with the stuff, and this was a singularly bad time for on-the-job training. The TV told the story. The chairman of the Federal Reserve Bank had been on all the morning talk shows, which had to have kept his driver busy in D.C. this day, followed by a strong public statement at the White House press room, followed by a lengthy interview on CNN. It was working after a fashion, and TV showed that as well. A lot of people had shown up at banks before lunch, surprised there to find piles of cash trucked out the previous night, to make what in military terms was probably called a show of force. Though the chairman had evidently jawboned every major banker in the country, the reverse was true of the tellers meeting depositors at their windows. "Oh, you want cash? Well, of course, we have all you need." In not a few cases, by the time people got home, they started to feel a new variety of paranoia. Keep all this cash at home? And by afternoon, some had even begun coming back to redeposit. That would be Buzz Fiedler's work, too, and a good man he was, Winston thought, for an academic. The Treasury Secretary was only buying time and doing so with money, but it was a good tactic, good enough to confuse the public into believing things were not as bad as they appeared. Serious investors knew better. Things were bad, and the play in the banks was a stopgap measure at best. The Fed was dumping cash into the system. Though a good idea for a day or so, the net effect by the end of the week had to be to weaken the dollar further still, and already American T-bills were about as popular in the global financial community as plague rats. Worst of all, though Fiedler had prevented a banking panic for the time being, you could hold back a panic only so long, and unless you could restore confidence in a real way, the longer you played stopgap games, the worse would be the renewed panic if those measures failed. For then there would be no stopping it. That was what Winston really expected. Because the Gordian knot around the throat of the investment system would not soon be untied. Winston thought he had decoded the likely cause of the event, but along the way he'd learned that there might not be a solution. The sabotage at DTC had been the masterstroke. Fundamentally, no single person knew what he owned, what he'd paid for it, when he'd gotten it, or what cash he had left, and the absence of knowledge was metastatic.
Individual investors didn't know, institutions didn't know, the trading houses didn't know, nobody knew. How would the real panic start? In short order, pension funds would have to write their monthly checks, but would the banks honor them? The Fed would encourage them to do so, but somewhere along the line there would be one bank that would not, due to troubles of its own. Just one. Such things always began in a single place, after all. And that would start yet another cascade, and the Fed would have to step in again by boosting the money supply, and that could start a hyperinflationary cycle. That was the ultimate nightmare.